The Guardian.
Support for this podcast comes from Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes creating a professional website for your business, personal brand, or portfolio so easy, it's newsworthy. Go to squarespace.com and use the offer Guardian to get 10% off.
The Guardian Books Podcast with Claire Armistead.
Hello and welcome to a special edition of the Guardian Books Podcast, in which we're celebrating National Poetry Day. For those of you who live outside the UK, it's a day that celebrates poets and poems across the country in schools, libraries and concert halls. And though it falls on October the 2nd, it's very much a week-long celebration. 2014 is a special year for poetry for another reason. It's the year when the Poetry Book Society selects the next generation of poets, 20 rising stars from England and Ireland, who this august establishment believes will take the art form forward for the next decade. They've just been announced, and with me in the studio is one of the poets charged with putting the list together, Claire Pollard. Welcome, Claire.
Hi.
Also with us is Tom Chivers, director and founder of Penned in the Margins, a publisher that regards poetry and performance as being two sides of the same thing and specialises in showcasing the work of those poets who, in your own words, Tom, are not afraid to take risks. I see you clenching your hands.
Yeah. Hello.
We'll hear more from you about your own particular projects later. But first, let me ask you both about the event that was one of the highlights of this week, which was the annual Forward Prize for Poetry. Claire, how prestigious are the Forwards? Are they a big event?
Oh, yeah, definitely. Up with the T.S. Eliot's. They're the two big events, I guess, in the poetry calendar. Excuse for a party when poets are involved.
Yes, and a lot of alcohol swishing around afterwards. What does it mean to poets to win one?
Well, what's big about the Forwards is it's not just a main collection prize, which you get at the T.S. Eliot, which is obviously, the rubber stamp that you really made it, that Kai Miller got this week. But there's also a first collection prize. So that's the one everybody really wants to win when they're starting out. And there's a prize for an individual poem, which I think is actually really important, because that's how a lot of people consume poetry, poem by poem, and it's a lot of poets would say they'd be glad in a lifetime if they wrote a dozen of those single poems that, people remember. That's what we're all in it for.
We'll come back to what it might mean to write a great single poem a bit later. But this has become an increasingly starry event, which was staged this year at the Queen Elizabeth Hall on London's South Bank, with the singer-songwriter Kerris Matthews emceeing and the actor Sam West leading a quartet of very well-known performers in a medley of readings from the Forward Book of Poems, which is compiled every year from the entries to the single poem competition. This year's chair was the broadcaster Jeremy Paxman, who spoke with his usual acerbic wit.
Thank you very much for coming. As you all know, doubtless, this is missionary work, really. It's evangelical. The ambition is to spread the gospel of poetry in a land which often seems to have forgotten it. But poetry isn't dead. As the audience at many a live reading will attest, as will the fact that I have ducked and dived and begged to get seats to hear Kate Tempest in this very room in a couple of weeks' time, and failed. And only this morning received an email saying that the alternative venue I'd sought, which was in Oxford, was also sold out. I will tell you that we have read literally thousands of poems over the past few months. Some of it was touching, much of it was thought-provoking, and some of it was terrible. The judging wasn't easy, but mercifully it wasn't too ferocious, despite the fact that there were strong feelings on all sides. But I fear, really, that we've been a disappointment to the organisers of the Forward Prize. They advised us to cancel all engagements this afternoon, and indeed, as far as I could tell, for most of October, because we will be so locked in passionate argument. As it happened, we weren't. We were as amicable as a real ale convention. We were as jovial as a convention of sensible sandal wearers, we were as decisive as a Scottish referendum. It was all over in less than 2 hours today.
So the winner of this year's prize was Kai Miller, and he just happens to be one of the next generation poets as well. Kai's been on the poetry scene for several years now, Claire, hasn't he? What were the qualities that you saw in his work, and is this a moment for him?
Yeah, I'm absolutely crazy about Kai Miller. I think he's wonderful. I think he's the complete package, really. He's something that both me and Tom, who's here today, are both interested in, I think, is poets who cross those boundaries between page and stage. You can perform as well as write brilliantly on the page. And Kai does that fantastically. He's got such a good ear and he's such a good performer. You know, technically, the music of his poem is his poetry is exquisite. But at the same time, they bear rereading. And if you look on the page, he's someone who's very political and he's someone who's really got something to say. You know, there's some meat there to get your teeth into. I'm a major fan. And the first black man to win the Forward Prize is obviously a very important moment as well. I think that's something we were very interested in. The Next Gen list was showing great strides have happened in the last 10 years in terms of diversity in the poetry scene, pushing, saying why are there not more kind of black and Asian poets being published by the major publishers. And there's been a real sea change and such a wave of new talent. I think Kai is at the absolute forefront of that.
Let's hear from some of the people who are at the event and how they received Kai's win.
Hello, I'm Jo Bell, former director of National Poetry Day, General Poetry Chick. And I've just listened to Liz Berry and Kai Miller, the winners of the two main prizes, and I am just utterly delighted. I had tears in my eyes most of the night, and it's fantastic that those two winners are so much about celebrating the bedrock voices, the voices of the places that they're from, both spiritually and geographically.
I'm absolutely delighted that Kai Miller won the Forward Prize tonight. I think it so celebrates the vernacular in dialogue with the highbrow, and I just think it's a very intelligent book, very thoughtful, very moving, and very political as well. So all round, I think it's an absolute top-rate choice.
I'm Margaret Busby, and I am delighted with the result. And I think Kai Miller is a fantastic poet. I've seen him here, heard him in Trinidad reading, and he just has such a fresh way of putting words together and making one see the world. And I'm so busy celebrating, I can hardly get my words together. But I think it's a fantastic choice.
Now, I was lucky enough to have a solo audience with Kai in the studio the day after his big win, when he came in to talk about the prize, his poetry, and some of the influences that have driven it forward. Kai, you seemed pretty speechless last night when you heard that you'd won the Forward Prize for Best Collection. Was it really that unexpected?
Certainly for me, it felt that unexpected. I mean, it was just such a kind of stellar lineup, you know, people who you're up against. That in my own mind, I felt I was coming way from left field. So yeah, it was overwhelming. But I think more it was, and I don't usually think in those terms, but I thought it was the first time a writer of colour had ever won it. And I felt it meant something a lot more than me. And I just knew immediately the people who would call and say, and who have been calling to say, this means so much for my voice. And that was what felt overwhelming, and I couldn't verbalise any of what that moment meant.
This is your fourth collection.
It is.
The Cartographer Tries to Map a Way to Zion. It's quite a complicated title. Tell us what the conception of it is.
Ostensibly, it's about a cartographer who visits Jamaica to map out the roads, and he ends up in conversation with a Rastaman who has a very different way of understanding place and landscape and measurement and so they exchange ideas. But I think that stands as a metaphor for several other things. It's a poem about writing. It's a poem about how the measurements that we use as poets, do we use the iambic pentameter or do we use other measurements? And how do universal ways of understanding place, how do those sometimes come in and displace local ways of knowing or writing or speaking. So on the surface, it's about measurement. It's about different ways of measuring things. But it's a metaphor for a lot more.
Will you read us a couple of the poems which establish the voices of these characters?
The cartographer tries to map a way to Zion, one in which the cartographer explains himself. You might say my job is not to lose myself exactly, but to imagine what loss might feel like. The sudden creeping pace, the consultation with trees and blue fences and whatever else might prove a landmark. My job is to imagine the widening of the unfamiliar and also the widening ache of it. To anticipate the ironic question, how did we find ourselves here? My job is to untangle the tangled, to unworry the concerned, to guide you out from cul-de-sacs into which you may have wrongly turned. Two, in which the Rastaman disagrees. The Rastaman has another reasoning. He says, no, that man's job is never straightforward or easy. Him work is to make thin and crushable all that is big and as real as ourselves, is to make flat all that is high and rolling, is to make invisible and worthless plenty things that poor people can't do without, like board houses or the corner shop from which Miss Katie sell our famous peanut porridge. And then again, the map maker's work is to make visible all them things that should have never existed in the first place, like the conquest of pirates, like borders, like the viral spread of governments.
So there are lots of things going on in those two poems. One is actually the forms are very different.
Right.
Where it's really interesting to hear you reading them because you go into a completely different sort of linguistic register. But these characters who develop during the course of the sequence of poems, they're not actually obvious stereotypes, are they? The Rastaman isn't a bit of rough, and the cartographer isn't a sort of pompous, Oxbridge-educated person who has no idea of anything local.
No, exactly. I mean, I'm not even sure who the cartographer is racially. But by the time he's sucking his teeth, I think that's complicating that. You know, why did you think he was white if you thought he was white before? Why is this not about just different ways of knowing a place? And yes, the Rastaman is fully conversant with Western ways of knowing. You know, he has a PhD in a European university. His dismissal of certain ways of knowing comes from being completely conversant with it. So I was absolutely trying to disrupt those binaries, and so that's why the registers aren't steady. And so the Rastaman himself, I mean, if you look at his vocabulary, he's absolutely using Rastafari dialect, but then it will slide into something very academic at another point. And that's what I was trying to do.
Well, like the viral spread of governments with which he ends
which he suddenly, yeah.
It just comes out of the blue, that line. You say, yeah. Oh, this is as much part of how he speaks.
Exactly.
There's a real preoccupation with land, isn't it? What is the particular thing that land means to Rastafari people?
For them, they were displaced. As black people, they were, Africa was stolen from them, and they were put on a new... They were put on a new side of the world. And, you know, there's an idea that you can't just give people freedom. You have to give them the means to enact that freedom. And because they never had land, it meant that by paper you declared them free, but they were never allowed to be free. And so Rastafari is a lot that we... a big part of Rastafari is, one, we have to reclaim Africa, the physical land of it. But there's an obsession, even in Jamaica, with we have to possess land in order to enact the freedom that you pretended to give us, but that it wasn't ever possible for us to live out that freedom, and which is what the collection becomes, that the cartographer begins to try to find his way to this Zion that Rastafari is obsessed about, this particular piece of land that's a home for them.
Yeah. You described yourself as a rebel. And you dropped out of university, which is a very rebellious thing to do in a way, isn't it? Tell us a little bit about that.
I would always say that dropping out was the single most important thing I did in order to become a writer. And I'll never regret it because of that. And I think it's simply that all my peers, they actually had occupations that they could claim. I have a degree in journalism. I am a journalist. I have a degree in medicine. I am a doctor. I have a degree in law. I am a lawyer. And they all went out into the work world, and became these things that their degrees gave them the kind of legitimacy to claim. And I was a dropout, so Kai, what are you? And you had to claim something, so I claimed I'm a writer. And if you claimed you're a writer, then you suddenly had to write. So I was doing odd jobs. I worked in advertising for a while as a copywriter, but I was writing. And so in those couple of years, I wrote my first two books.
So what made you decide that it was Manchester you were going to go to? Of all the places in the world, you didn't go to the States, you came to a northern city in the UK.
It was absolutely the right place to end up. Manchester was brilliant.
Not least for the poetry slams, which helped finance your MA.
Yeah, that's even that overstated. It was £100 that I won. It didn't finance the whole year, but certainly in that first week.
You won it in your first week in Manchester. You were national champion 2004.
Yes, it was my first. It was not only my first week. It's probably my within the first 2 days, money hadn't arrived from Jamaica yet. I thought, God, I need money. There's a slam down the road. Let's go. And so that £100 for that for the next 2 weeks was excessively beneficial, so that's how that came about. And then on, I've been declared a slam poet or a slam champion.
But you read very quietly at the forwards. I was wondering whether you were going to come out and be declaiming. But slamming is presumably a completely different sort of aesthetic.
Yes and no. I often think it depends on what you consider performance. And sometimes I think the most powerful performance is a performance that understands the power of silence. And so actually, I don't like a lot of slam poetry because I think it's overperformed or because their performances only understand one note. And so it's easy for slam poetry to become a parody of itself. And so what you call good performance is really just over-exuberant, ill-considered performance. But I've seen some of the most amazing poets. Linton Kwesi Johnson is a very, very quiet, very still, very solid performer. He refuses applause during the length of his shows, and it's you will sit down and you will listen to this. I think we have to have a much more expansive idea of what performance is, and then what the right performance of a poem is.
One thing we haven't talked about at all is your politics. You're a very prolific blogger and tweeter, as well as a short story writer, novelist and a poet. And one of your stories appeared in a book festival commission in the summer as part of Letters Home, which was a promenade performance. And it was about the transformation of a young man on a plane from Jamaica to England into a transvestite, as seen by two friends of his mother who were reporting back.
Well, not a transvestite exactly. I never thought of it as a trans performance. But you know, you're absolutely right. It is that. I was just assuming a move from masculinity to something that's more effeminate, so that the clothes get tighter, that his walk is more exaggerated in another kind of way. But it is a move towards the transgender that it just never occurred to me before.
How interesting. I absolutely saw it as that. Now, this is one of your political crusades, isn't it? You've been very, very outspoken, particularly about Jamaican homophobia. Talk a little bit about your politics and why that's so important to you.
I mean, one of the hard things is that that politics keep on shifting and they keep on getting more complicated. Which is probably one of the big themes about, the book The Cartographer Tries to Map Away to Zion, that nothing is resolved, that I seem to glory in saying, here is the mess of it all, here are how things continually deconstruct themselves, and here is how it, you think I'm arguing this line, but no, I'm going to undermine it. And that's a big part of, I think, being political, accepting that things are messy and that answers aren't easy. So I don't know what my politics are outside of sounding extremely hokey and saying that I think I always hope that the world could be a better place. And I think love is important. And I think we ought to love each other. And I think that whenever you realize that there are ways in which the world is constructed in ways that undermine that undermine people's their humanity, and who they are that makes people less than who they are, that you ought to always confront that, and that you ought to always call out people on those levels of demeaning people. I think that's a consistent in what my politics are. And so I will always speak out about homophobia. I'll always speak out about different kinds of racial injustices, but especially when those things are subtle. I mean, I think that's what I glory in. I glory in the subtlety of when we don't realize that we're doing these things. What we're fighting against is not to demean people. You can't fight. You can't do that by doing it again. And I think that's why my politics become very, very complex for me. And hard to articulate, hard to say, I get what you're doing, I honour what you're doing, but you end up doing something else that negates it.
Thank you. You're 35, you've got the world ahead of you, you've just won a big prize. You could do anything in literary terms. What is going to come next?
A novel that I've been working on forever, which I don't think will be a novel. But I do think it's a long story about a place in Jamaica called Augusttown, where a man called Alexander Bedwood in 1930, this was just about before Rastafari was about to start, and so it's Rastafari again. Bedwood prophesied that he was going to fly, and he didn't. And there's a huge story in that about this man who claimed he was going to fly. And that's a story I've been trying to tell for a while.
So we look forward to meeting Alexander.
Alexander Bedwood, yeah.
Thank you very much.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace. When it's time to create a website for whatever's newsworthy in your life, whether that's a small business, online store, professional portfolio, or just a blog, go to squarespace.com and use the offer Guardian to get 10% off.
Claire, I've mentioned that Kai was one of the next generation poets. Tell us a little bit more about how you put this list together.
Well, you know, as ever, these lists are a compromise. There were five people in the room and, you know, there were people all of us wanted on the list that didn't get on. We have very different tastes, some of us in that room. But I think at the end of the day, we were told to choose on the books rather than the poets and what we knew about the poets and what they were doing in the world. And we got down to a list of 20 books that we all agreed, even if it wasn't quite our thing and there were other people we might have wanted on the list, we all agreed those were really good books. You know, there was no getting around the fact that all those 20 people can really write. And I think it's a good list because we all had such different taste, because there is such diversity on the list. I think from, you know, people like Kate Tempest to much more kind of erudite, difficult poetry, someone like Annie Freud, who I think you really need to spend
time with.
Well,
she's 66 years old, so hardly the next generation.
Well, not in terms of actual age, no, Claire, but that's taking it a bit literally. But actually, there is a real buzz around Annie, and I think she is very much of this generation that's coming up with her kind of surreal, ironic, American-inflected poetry. She's been very influential, as is Luke Kennard, Emily Berry. They're all very much of the zeitgeist doing this kind of American-inflected poetry, and I think Annie was at the forefront of that. So she's new.
Tom, one of your poets is on the list. She's Melissa Lee Houghton, who is up for Beautiful Girls.
Yes.
Tell us about her.
Melissa is an extraordinary writer. She's extremely raw. She writes a lot about mental illness, and she writes about it in a way that is incredibly true to the voice that she has, the imaginative voice that she has. People often describe her work as honest or authentic, and I actually think that's not really what the best poetry does. I don't think it tells truths, it tells lies, but it does it in such a raw and fresh way. And she really does that, and I'm extremely pleased that her book has been put onto this next generation list, and it means a huge deal for her as well.
Claire, I'm interested in that line from Tom, it doesn't tell truths, it tells lies, but tells them in a fresh way. Now, you've got quite a few people on this list who have stories, come with life stories,
yes,
don't they? Not least Sam Willits, mm-hmm, with a story of addiction. Are you saying that maybe he isn't an addict at all?
I'm not saying anything of the kind, Claire. Where did you get that from? I would slightly disagree. Well, I agree and disagree with Tom. I'm very interested in confessional poetry. That was kind of my subject at university. I love Anne Sexton, and she talks about faking it up with the truth. I am very interested in people who have experiences and something to say about life. And I that's what I'm hungry for when I go to poetry. I want to learn about what it is to be human and different ways of being alive. I love the technical side, but I'm not in it for the technical side. I'm in it for the stories.
I mentioned the idea of what is the next gen in the context of Annie Freud, and I totally take your point. It's nothing to do with age. But there was a bit of grumbling about some of the names, including Daljit Nagra, who was there for his brilliant collection, Look We Have Coming for Dover, which was long-listed and indeed shortlisted for the Guardian First Book Prize. Ooh, how many years ago? 7 years ago? 8 years ago? He's been around for a very long time.
Yeah, well, this is there's a tension at the heart of this whole list, which is essentially we were told to pick 10 brilliant books from the last 10 years. That's what we were told as judges, which is actually a very different thing from picking who are going to be the influential next. In fact, there's been such a change in poetry over the last 10 years. Actually, the people who are the real next gen, the people who are really coming up, are all publishing pamphlets at the moment. They didn't even qualify for the list because you had to have a full collection out. You know, people often have a couple of pamphlets now before they have a full collection. So they've often been around on the scene 10 years before their debut even comes out. So there is the list, it was never going to be quite a list of the true next gen in that sense.
Tom, some of them are probably being published by you.
Hopefully, yeah. I wanted to pick up on that wonderful phrase of Claire's, that it holds attention in the list. Because I think that actually what a good list does is exactly that. It can describe not just one way of thinking about poetry, but numerous, some of which might actually be in opposition to each other. And for me, that's what gets me excited. It's the tension between different kinds of poetries. And maybe that's one of the changes we've experienced in the last 10, 15 years, is away from one way of writing poetry only and towards lots of different. And also synthesis. I think that's one of the big words for me looking forward.
Kai Miller, in that interview, talked about his shame that he'd felt about being having won poetry slams and the difference between being a sit-down and a stand-up poet. And this is something which you exploit in your catalogue, don't you, Tom?
Yes.
What are you exactly? Are you a publisher or an impresario or a curator? What are you?
I describe myself as a producer and a publisher. I think really what I'm interested in is ideas, language and stories. And however, whatever media I might find to tell those and to explore those ideas, I'm not too worried. So sometimes it's a book, sometimes it might be a touring production, a performance, and sometimes it might be something completely different. I'm very excited by what digital art might hold for poetry as well and for literature. So I'm kind of all of those things, really. But as you say, I'm really interested in page and stage and trying to dismantle the barriers between them.
One of the things Jeremy Paxman said in his rather sort of typically grouchy forward address was that to be a poet of the printed page is to clamber aboard the TGV of penury, i.e. there's no money to be made in it. Nobody reads it. There's lots of people writing it, but not particularly reading it. Do you agree with that, Claire?
No. Well, I do agree that it's hard to make much money in poetry. I do think people read it, though. I think that's a completely different thing altogether. I suppose what Jeremy's hinting at is that the book sales for, you know, your classic 64-page full collection aren't enormous if you compare them to figures for novels and so on. But, you know, I see a real interest in poetry, actually. I think people... It's often what people reach for, both when they want to express themselves and, you know, at those important moments in their lives, funerals and weddings and baptisms. They consume it in all sorts of ways. They have it pinned to their fridge. You know, they listen to it on the radio. They go to lots of live literature these days. You know, there's loads of festivals like Latitude, and the tents are full of people listening to poetry. And poetry is really suited to the internet. So there's people reading millions of poems on the internet that, you know, doesn't show up as book sales. It's a poem is the perfect length for a YouTube clip. It's, you know, perfect length to put up an audio file. It suits blogs. It suits Twitter. Poems are going viral all the time now. So this idea, it's a very old-fashioned idea that just because we're not selling physical books, you know, people aren't reading poetry.
To be fair to Jeremy, he did also say that he tried to beg, borrow and steal a ticket for Kate Tempest's gigs both in Oxford and in London and had been unable to get tickets for either of them. So let's just listen in to what's so special about her.
So this is an extract from Brand New Ancients. There have always been heroes, And there have always been villains. And yes, the stakes may have changed, but really there's no difference. There's always been heartbreak and greed and ambition and bravery and love and trespass and contrition. We are the same beings that began, and we're still living in all of our fury and foulness and friction. These are everyday odysseys. We have dreams. We make decisions. The stories are there if you listen. The stories are here. The stories are you, and your fear and your hopes are as old as the language of smoke, as old as the language of blood, as old as the language of languishing love. The gods are all here because the gods are in us. And the gods are in the betting shops, the gods are in the caf, the gods are smoking fags out the back. The gods are in their office blocks, the gods are at their desks, the gods are sick of always giving more and getting less. The gods are at the rave and they're two pills deep into dancing, the gods are in the alleyways laughing. The gods are at the doctors. They just need a little something for the stress. The gods are in the toilets having unprotected sex. The gods are in the supermarket. The gods are walking home. The gods can't stop checking Facebook on their phone. The gods are in a traffic jam. The gods are on a train. The gods are watching adverts. The gods are not to blame. The gods are working for the council. The gods are on the dole. The gods are getting drunk, pissing their wages down a hole. The gods are in their gardens and they're staring at the plants. The gods are in the classrooms. Those poor things don't stand a chance. The gods are trying to tell the truth, but the truth is hard to say. The gods are born, they live a while, and then they pass away.
That was Kate Tempest reading from Brand New Ancients. Our next poet is Sam Willits, who we've already heard a little bit about.
This poem is called Honest John. In confinement, imagined he was filling his pen from an inkwell of his own urine, saw the pale script fading as it dried to the invisible ink of his obscurity. Starving on the run, falls to his hands and knees like Nebuchadnezzar to eat grass. Keeps walking back to what does not exist, long dead first love, landscape of youth, back to the days before the Sunday best of his brief celebrity. Thick-fingered daisy chainer, he knew once how to become very small, could read aloud the small names of God he saw written through the song-struck woods, could enter the tiny world of a ladybird in a high wind. Fugitive again, he knows the constellations and takes their giant word in laying himself head north, feet south, to know his way before first light. But first light sees him far down a wrong road, foul-mouthing the new land and sky as they spin him in their cockeyed compass, misleading him from his way home.
And finally, Helen Mort. Claire, tell us about her.
I think she was a shoo-in for the next journalist. She's been a very influential young poet. Again, a poet who's really built a reputation over the last 10 years with pamphlets and performing lots until people were absolutely salivating for her debut collection to come out, I think. For me, I really like her as a strong northern voice, I guess, coming out of those kind of working class roots. She has a fabulous poem called Scab, about going to Cambridge and feeling like a scab, really.
It's about, it comes out of the miners' strike, doesn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, it's wonderful.
Here she is, reading from Division Street.
You brought me here to break it off one muggy Tuesday. A brewing storm, the pigeons sleek with rain. My black umbrella flexed its wings. Damp-skinned, I made for the crush of bars, where couples slip white pills from tongue to tongue. Light as drizzle, your fingers through my hair, the way you nearly sneaked a little something in my blood. At the clinic, they asked if I'd tattoos. I thought about the parlour with its jaundiced walls, the knit-knit whine of needle-dotting bone, and for a moment, almost wished you'd left your mark. Subtle as the star I cover with T-shirts, the memory of rain, or your head-down walk along Division Street, slower each week, pausing by the pubs, their windows so dim you see nothing but your own reflection.
And that's all from us this week. Thanks to Claire Pollard, Tom Chivers and Kai Miller, and of course Jeremy Paxman. Until next week, from me, Claire Armistead, and my producer, Eva Krissak, goodbye.